The Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt. Representative Cleburne.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Fighting the ice dams.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Here.
Representative Hewitt.
I'm here.
That concludes roll call.
Very well, members. Getting my words mixed up. A quorum is present. This hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations, in response to the COVID-19 infectious disease pandemic requiring public health exercise of social distancing. The public can view House Rule 10.01 on the Minnesota House website, as well as visit the Public Safety, Criminal Justice Reform page on the Minnesota House website for information on how to access this hearing via live stream video, as well as instructions for how to participate in public testimony. Members, I think we've got just one item of business today, and I'm anticipating a very good conversation and learning. Really anticipating hearing back from the task force that is issuing recommendations for us today for criminal sexual conduct statutory reform. Before we do that, though, I want to make sure we adopt our minutes. And if I could have a motion then to adopt the minutes of February 16th, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to adopt the minutes from February 15th.
Representative Frazier moves adoption of the minutes from February 16th. Discussion to that motion? If not, then all in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of February 16th are hereby adopted. It's always my pleasure to welcome Representative Mueller back to our committee. It's becoming a habit now. Hopefully, she'll have even more bills coming forward in the coming weeks. But Representative Mueller, welcome back to the committee. I'm really looking forward to the presentation on House File 707. The chair will move to refer House File 707 to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Mueller, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we present the bill, I believe that Suzanne Elwell from the Office of Justice Programs was going to give a brief overview to members of the great work that the working group did and the report and recommendations that came out of that work.
Super. It's good to have that context. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Elway. If you can state your name for the record and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My name is Suzanne Elwell from the Office of Justice Programs in the Department of Public Safety, and I'm here to provide an overview of the Criminal Sexual Conduct Statutory Reform Working Group. And if I could, I'll share my screen.
Please.
And I just want to confirm you can see my slides.
I can't as of yet.
All right, let's try that again.
Something good's happening here. There we go. We now have access to your slides.
Great. We're in business. Thank you. All right. So the legislature in 2019 directed the Commissioner of Public Safety to convene a working group. I was appointed the facilitator, and the directive from the legislature was to have a multidisciplinary working group that included prosecutors, defense attorneys, Sentencing Guidelines Commission, law enforcement, and others. We were directed to strive for a broad view of viewpoints, a spectrum of viewpoints, be inclusive of marginalized community, and include the voices of victims and survivors. Our first meeting was in August 2019, but most of the work took place in our subcommittees. We started out with a consent subcommittee talking about whether we needed to revise the definition of consent, which we concluded we did not. And then we had four committees that met simultaneously nearly through the entire process from September 2019 through August 2020. Age, force and coercion, which broke off into restructuring, capacity and profession occupations were the primary committees. And starting in February, the outcomes subcommittee met. Members were asked to self-select into the subcommittees. Some chose not to participate at the subcommittee level, instead waiting for the recommendations to emerge from that process and then weigh in at that point. And we asked all our stakeholders to make sure that they kept in close communication with their stakeholder groups to make sure that they had representation on all the subcommittees and were communicating with each other about the proposals that were emerging from the subcommittee work. In general, we were looking for general agreement about the proposals in the subcommittee work. The meetings were open to all members of the public. Meetings were announced on the working group website. All the materials were posted, and members were given periodic updates by email. Finally, through all the subcommittee work, the proposals that emerged from that work were then distributed to all working group members to review. And rather than having one big review meeting, we instead had a series of review meetings, six in all, where members could attend, ask questions, provide feedback, and help us make refinements to those recommendations. Those final set of recommendations were identified, and the final review was by our steering committee, which was made up of all the stakeholders. Following the recommendations, the report to the legislature was drafted. And again, we had stakeholder input on the report to make sure they reviewed it, to make sure that the report was reflective of the will and the sentiment of the working group, and that all the recommendations were appropriately presented. So I'm going to do a high level overview of the recommendations, anticipating that through Representative Moeller and her testifiers can talk about the more specifics of each of these proposals. One of the primary reasons that the working group was formed was to deal with a well-known issue about the definition of mentally incapacitated. Currently, that definition just covers the situation where the victim or complainant is incapacitated through involuntary intoxication. It does not cover those situations where a victim, complainant, is voluntary intoxication to the point that they have the inability to consent. They lack the capacity to consent. So capacity subcommittee addressed this issue, trying to find a proposal that would be agreeable to all. Unfortunately, we did not come to a general agreement on this particular point, and instead we had alternate proposals that were suggested. The committee committee agreed that we would put forward both of these options in front of the legislature. One would just to expand the definition of incapacitation to include voluntary intoxication, and the other would create a new crime addressing voluntary intoxication in CSC 3 and 4. I note here just a case that came about after we had already made this, came up with this proposal. It does directly impact it's directly on point with the definition of mentally incapacitated. We did reconvene just to address whether we should alter our recommendation and decided that we would not. There are two new crimes that are being proposed within the set of recommendations. The first is sexual extortion. This would create a new crime allowing for prosecution of cases where the actor uses threats to the victim or complainant that does not involve threats of physical harm. For example, the threat to fire them from their employment, the threat to evict them from their home, the threat to deny them benefits that they're entitled to. The second one is the fifth degree criminal sexual conduct. It's meant to address a gap in our current statutory scheme for those situations in which there is non-consensual sexual act, but no force or coercion is present. This would create a felony level CSC 5. There was much discussion about age-based offenses. And out of that discussion came three general recommendations, age-related recommendation. The first is dealing what we call the defining age. Right now, we treat offenses more seriously if the victim or the complainant is under the age of 13, meaning they're 12 years old or younger. The recommendation from the working group is to change that to under 14, meaning age 13 and younger, that we would treat those as more serious offenses than those above those ages. In addition, this is a topic that might sound familiar to this committee as it's been discussed before, is the need to have consistent age differentials within those age-based offenses. Within CSC 1 through 4, there's age differentials that range from 24 difference between the actor and complainant, 36 months, and 48 months. The recommendation from the working group is that to make that a consistent 36 months. And finally, there's a recommendation to reduce the age span for which the defense of mistake of age is available. Currently, it's at 120 months, and it would be reduced to 60 months between the actor and the complainant. One of the other major complaints about our current statutory scheme is that it is confusing and hard to access. And there was a desire to look at restructuring the statutory scheme so that's more understandable for criminal justice professionals, for victims, for members of the public. As we had this discussion, we had great discussions about how we can go about restructuring the statutory framework. And there was a desire to take a wholesale approach, that to take it apart and rebuild it from the ground up. And that to do so, as we had these conversations, we realized that it would take a great deal of time because of really starting from scratch, having new terminology, and needing to be mindful about how this would impact our sentencing scheme as well. We decided that this was beyond the capacity of this existing working group to tackle, at the same time feeling that this was the right direction to go. So the recommendation from the working group was two-step. One, make minor revisions to the current statutory scheme, and that would involve just some refinements and reorganization, but two, to recommend that there be a wholesale restructuring statutory reform working group again, which is a lot, we know. There's also proposals to amend current language, one for the definition of coercion, a minor refinement to just make clear that coercion could involve the situation where the complainant may fear infliction of bodily harm by someone other than the actor, such as an accomplice. And then the other one is to deal with a problem that's well known to prosecutors and defense attorneys about the overlap in CSC first degree and CSC third degree due to the circularity of definitions of force, bodily harm, and personal injury. In particular, you could have an actor who engages in a same set of circumstances or a particular set of circumstances and be charged with CSC 3 or CSC 1, which prompts a constitutional issue. So in order to resolve that problem, the recommendation is under CSC 3 in the provision that says the act occurred as a result of force and coercion to just take out the term force and it would just be coercion. And the working group felt that that would resolve that constitutional problem. There's also a whole set of provisions within our statutory scheme that address the areas where a complainant has a relationship with a person in a particular profession or occupation. And now the crime is that when a sex act occurs in this situation between the complainant and someone they have a professional or occupational relationship with, that is prohibited. An example would be a correctional officer is not supposed to have sex with an inmate. A person who drives special transportation services is not to engage in sexual relationships with those people on their bus. And there's a variety of others, clergy, massage therapists, etc. The idea was to, in the first idea in the set of recommendations related to prohibited occupational relationships is to move the list that we now see in CSC 3 and 4 to the definition sections. One, just to make it a little easier to read for CSC 3 and 4, but two, to make it easier if there's going to be refinements in the definition of prohibited occupational relationship, it can take place in that single place. The second part of the recommendation is just to clarify some of the language of those prohibited occupational relationships, not changing the actual crime or the circumstances, but just to clarify the language. Probably most importantly of the set of recommendations has to do with expanding the definition of prohibited occupational relationship to include certain employees in educational settings, trying to close the gap that many prosecutors see in the education setting. An example is right now, a person who's in a position of authority in a school is not supposed to have sexual acts with a student. But there are others in that educational setting who are not in a position of authority, but still within that school setting, that it's not prohibited. This would close some of those gaps that we see in educational settings. And the fourth recommendation has to do with making consistency in how we treat prohibited occupational relationships. Right now, there's a prohibition on certain carriers in facility situations with having sexual contact acts with those that they are caring for. That's a prohibited occupational relationship defined in criminal sexual abuse. This recommendation would move that particular one into our definition of prohibited occupational relationships. Also, finally, the final ones are just a change in the definition of significant relationship. Right now, that includes a parent's partner, girlfriend, boyfriend who lives in the household, and we would recommend expanding a significant relationship to include those persons who are a partner, boyfriend, or girlfriend of a parent who does not live in the household. And the final recommendation is just to remove those archaic and unconstitutional provisions currently existing in our statutory scheme, including sodomy, adultery, and fornication. We started out this process in August 2019 with presentations from our stakeholders, our victim survivor stakeholders, and victim service providers of underserved populations and marginalized populations. They presented to us the concerns and issues they saw with the response by the criminal justice system to sexual assault, and set the tone for the work that we did. A lot of the issues and concerns that they brought up then and brought up throughout our process were not related specifically to CSC 1 through 5, which is the mandate of our working group, and instead were what we called the front end issues, how we respond to criminal sexual assault. And there are issues that many of us are acquainted with. Because we wanted to make sure that those voices were included in this process and in this report, there is a supplement to the report that lists those issues that they brought up at the beginning, as well as brought up throughout the process to make sure that they are also brought to the attention of the legislature. In addition, starting at the very beginning of our subcommittee work, one of the concerns that would be brought up repeatedly is about the impact of what we are doing on marginalized communities, BIPOC communities, and offenders in those communities. And one of the big issues that would rise up over and over again by all stakeholders has to do with predatory offender registration and the need for reform. And it was brought up so much that we addressed that in our outcomes subcommittee and talked about it at length. The group that met looked at areas where there could be agreement. And when I talk about who was there, we had prosecutors and defense attorneys and victims and victim advocates having this conversation and formulating a set of ideas and proposals to put forward. Unfortunately, POR reform is outside the scope of our statutory mandate, but because we wanted, again, to have these voices heard and acknowledge the issues that were brought up over and over and over again in our discussions, there is a supplement too in the working group report that reflects those conversations and the ideas that emerged and as a starting point for a further conversation. What is recommended from the working group is that a POR reform working group be established to look at that particular area. And finally, I just want to say thank you to the working group members that participated in this process. We had a lot of voices and a lot of effort that went into this, a lot of respective discord. Many people put in many, many hours of work to make this happen, and I appreciate their dedication to this effort. And for now, I'll answer any questions people might have.
Thank you, Ms. Elwell. I actually have several, but I'm also noting that we have quite a few individuals who are signed up to testify, and I'm very anxious to hear their voices. So I'm gonna hold off on my questions, and hopefully we will have some a period toward the end where we can do that. Thank you again for your work, your facilitation work, as well as for your presentation here today. Representative Mueller, should we begin with your testifiers? Is that appropriate?
So, Mr. Chair, I did have a bill introduction. I wanted to walk through the bill. But before we do that, I do have the A2 amendment, and I'm wondering if we can move that amendment.
Indeed. So we have an author's amendment here, the A2 amendment. The chair will move the A2 amendment. Discussion. Members, I think I need to do all of these by roll call, unfortunately. So the clerk will take the roll on the motion.
Chair Mariani?
Yes, Representative Johnson.
If you would prefer on this amendment, I don't think we have any problems with it. If you just want to use the raise hand function.
I think that's okay. The issue had more to do with technical, but I don't see any amendments to the amendment. Unless I hear otherwise from legal counsel on any issues for doing a oral vote on this. And I'm not seeing anything coming forward. So Representative Johnson, let's just go ahead and do the, let's do what you suggested. If you can raise your hands in the,
Chair Mary, might want to do that. We have too many people in the queue with questions, so we can do a voice vote.
And I did see a whole bunch of hands up, but okay. Members, all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 707 is adopted with the A2 amendment. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All of you are all of your images are changing around on my screen right now, but I think it's settled down. So, Mr. Chair and members, it's an honor to be before you to present this bipartisan bill, House File 707, a rewrite of the criminal sexual conduct statutes, and Senator Senjum will be introducing this bill in the Senate. I want to thank the chair for your unwavering support for survivors of sexual assault. Thank you to Suzanne Elwell and all the participants of the working group for your hard work over the last 2 years in meeting, developing recommendations, and writing an excellent report. Thanks to the media outlets for reporting on the flaws in our system for survivors of sexual assault. But most importantly, thank you to the brave survivors who have continued to tell their stories about how the criminal justice system has failed them. Survivors tell their stories in public, knowing that it often won't change anything about their own cases. However, they do this because they don't want the same thing to happen to someone else. They do this to create systems change, to provide justice for other survivors, to hold offenders accountable, and to shatter rape myths. It's an honor to walk alongside survivors in this work. We know changes to our system are necessary. Sexual assault crimes are highly unreported. And when they are reported, there is a very real possibility that they will not be fully investigated or charged or result in conviction. At the legislature, we have passed important laws to lead to systems change, including the requirement of post and law enforcement policies on investigations. And during a special session, we passed a law to test all rape kits. Members, the next stage in our efforts to provide justice is this bill. And I would like to give an overview of the bill language as amended, highlighting where the recommendations that Ms. Elwell described from the working group are incorporated. Section 1 adds voluntary intoxication to the current definition of mentally incapacitated. And I carefully considered the two options the working group provided and felt that this definition best addresses those cases involving victims voluntarily consuming intoxicants that are currently falling through the cracks. Sections 2 through 7 address the definition section currently in statute. The bill clarifies the definition of coercion, adds another significant relationship, and moves the current prohibited occupational relationships to this section. It expands the definition of prohibited occupational relationships to include certain employees in educational settings, as mentioned by Ms. Elwell. It also adds what's currently in the criminal abuse statute here, and then the amendment that you just adopted deletes that language from where it currently is in statute. Sections 8 through 11 are criminal sexual conduct first through fourth degree. And in current law, offenses against adults and children are mixed together in statute. It makes for a very confusing set of statutes. And so this bill separates out adult and child victims for clarity. Throughout these provisions are changes to the age-related offenses. And as discussed by Ms. Elwell, they include raising the age to protect more minor victims, creating consistent differentials between the age of the actor and complainant, and reducing the age span for the mistake of age defense. I will note that we may need a future amendment to address a problem that currently exists in statute where certain second and fourth degree crimes against children may involve the same conduct. It was just brought to our attention, and I'll be working with the stakeholders on this. The working group recommended that force be removed from third and fourth degree criminal sexual conduct, and those changes that Ms. Elwell discussed are incorporated in the bill. However, we realized that doing this created a gap for certain types of cases involving force, especially attempted force and threats of force. And the amendment, again, the one you just adopted, addresses that by clarifying that the definition of force and also adding force language back in where appropriate. The new crime of felony level fifth degree offense can be found at section 12. This addresses non-consensual sexual penetration cases that do not involve force or coercion, and we created the lowest level of felony offense here. Section 14 creates a new crime of sexual extortion. The working group talked about, and there are also letters in your packet that reflect how big of a problem this has come, particularly in the area of housing. There have been recent stories in Minnesota from St. Peter and Minneapolis about this. And in fact, it's such a problem nationwide that in 2017, the Department of Justice launched the Sexual Harassment in Housing Initiative. Section 13 of the bill was a catch by staff to add sexual extortion to the predicate offenses applicable to certain sentences. And we just discovered today that we likely need an amendment to reflect how our bill is now separating adult and child crimes. So we need some clarity in that section. Members, while the preliminary recommendations were available to me online in the fall and we started working on the bill then, it wasn't until the working group report was made available to me last month that I noticed two other recommendations that we incorporated into the amendment today. The first one is the repeal of the archaic laws that Ms. Elwell mentioned. And the second one is the creation of the working group to examine predatory offender registration statutes. I believe you'll hear more about that from testifiers, but I'll just note that while reforms to our criminal sexual conduct statutes are critical, we also recognize the need to reform other aspects of our system. And finally, Mr. Chair, as members of this committee know, Representative O'Neill has been working on policy for survivors for many years. Some of the changes set forth in this bill are ones that she advocated for in prior sessions. Representative O'Neill is passionate about this issue and participated in many of the working group meetings about this legislation. It's been a pleasure for me to collaborate with her, and I'm glad to co-present this bill with her. And Mr. Chair, she does have some comments now before our testifiers. Thanks.
Very well, Representative O'Neill, and let's be mindful, folks. We've got like 10 testifiers here. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually wanted to bring to Representative Mueller's attention that we were going to change something on line 12.5 because it still had the age of 24 months instead of 36 months. So I'm just bringing that to your attention that we need to put that together. But as far as my comments, yes, I was able to attend almost all of the working group meetings. We were back in person when we first started. It was quite amazing to sit at a table just outside of the ring of brilliant people. They were a collaboration of both prosecutors and defense attorneys and victims' rights people, and really a huge spectrum, including law enforcement and others. And they did an amazing work. They disagreed. They came to a collaborative understanding of what needed to happen. And there's still more work to be done. And I just wanted to briefly talk about the age part of it, because I had the Hanna bill, which we had done last biennium. And the Hanna bill talked a lot about a 13-year-old who was raped by two men in their 20s. And she was taken across state lines. She was held against her will. She was threatened. She was given alcohol and marijuana and possibly other intoxicants. And so even after review by a county attorney four times, the case was not brought forward. They had DNA evidence, they had Facebook messages and such. And so that really started my journey of looking really carefully at the crime sex statute to say what's working and what's not. And this bill is a culmination of years, 2 years in the working group, but many years before that, working with NCASA, working with Violence Free Minnesota and others, and victims themselves. And our amazing, I have to say this, our amazing, amazing staff, our nonpartisan staff who are on this call right now to help craft and put together all of the different pieces. So with that, just specifically about the ages, I wanted to just briefly talk about that. We basically took 13 and raised it up to 14 to cover more children, in acknowledgement that, that age really was kind of missed. It was a big conversation there. And also to make all of the ages between the actor and the victim 36 months. So it was between 24 months, 36 months, or 48 months. And so it was trying to simplify the fact that if you're 36 months older than the victim, that's problematic. Again, 16 is still the age of consent. The underlying statute wasn't changed necessarily, which is where we have come into issues with, as Representative Mueller said, crim sex 2 and 4 when it comes to under 14. But the underlying language will not change so much as the ages were changed, including shrinking the mistake of age as a defense, which is in crim sex 3, and then a little bit in crim sex 4. So I am very excited to work alongside of Representative Mueller and others to work on this piece. There's more work to be done as we've really done a deep dive into the statutes. There's more that needs to be done, which Representative Mueller alluded to, that we have that catch that the underlying statute is in conflict. And we need to fix that. We want to protect our children, so we actually have to fix that because it's not working the way it is. And as you recall, we had Representative Mueller had a bill last biennium that dealt with crim sex 1 and children 13 and under, or under 13, when it talked about penetration versus contact, and that was because of a court case. So there's more work to do. I'm very excited to hear what the testifiers have to say, because I know they want to talk about predatory offender registry, which is interplays with this so importantly. And so with that, I just want to thank you, and I look forward to continuing the work, because it's not finished. This is the beginning, and there's more to do, and I just stick with us. We've got a couple small amendments that need to be made. As I maybe Representative Mueller will do an oral amendment or something to fix the 24 to 36 that was missed. Kind of a technical issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just note that that was something that was part of the A2 amendment, but it's kind of buried in the language. That fix from 24 to 36 is at line 4.13. Terrific. So I think that's it. So I don't know that we need to fix that one now, but we are ready for our testifiers, Mr. Chair. And I believe Lindsay Bryce is up first.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Bryce. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lindsay Bryce. I am the Law and Policy Director for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I appreciate you having me here today and a number of us here today to have this conversation. 2 years ago, I sat here in front of you, well, not physically in this room. I was actually at the Capitol with you all, and asked you to create a multidisciplinary group that included the voices of survivors and included the voices of folks from marginalized communities. And to be clear, there's a huge amount of overlap there. And to create this group to examine and make recommendations to change and modernize Minnesota's criminal sexual conduct statutes. So we just spent about 18 months doing exactly that. I say 18 months, it feels like more like 2 years in all of the prep, but the conversation portion of it and the substantive work around this report that you're seeing, that was about 18 months of conversations and work. I've spent hours with this incredible group of caring, knowledgeable people talking about all of the different ways in which Minnesota's criminal sexual conduct statutes impact the lives of victims and survivors. I've watched seasoned professionals quiet themselves to listen to those with lived experiences. And I've watched people with lived experiences listen and learn more about the very complicated statutes that have so impacted their lives and often not for the better. Ever present in all of these conversations are the realities of disparities within our criminal justice system. I find that disparities are often talked about as impacting defendants, and that's true, they do. They also impact survivors who want or need to engage with our systems. So while defendants are part of that conversation, MCASA fully supports the conversation around POR that's also happening, we really tried to center our work on the impacts on survivors. We definitely didn't always agree, but the breadth of experience on the work group was a benefit. That was really the goal. It's a slower process, but hopefully it brings everybody along as we move forward. Not only were there survivors and advocates, but there was also law enforcement, public defenders, private defense attorneys, treatment providers, and so many others. We talked a lot about the problems that survivors face over and over and over, and whether there are ways to change Minnesota's criminal sexual conduct statutes to fix some of those problems without increasing disparities. Really, that's how most of those conversations were framed, and I frame it up as three different points. The first question was always, what is the problem that survivors are bringing to the forefront? What are we hearing and seeing happening over and over and over that isn't something that can be addressed by our current statutes? Is that something that could be impacted or improved by amending the criminal sexual conduct statutes? Does it fit within this charge that we were given, right? Is it broader than that? And you have a list of all the different things that came up that are also really important, but that really went beyond this criminal sexual conduct statute question. And then is there a way to do that, to make those changes and recommendations of changes to these statutes without unintended consequences and disparities and those kinds of negative pieces? I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this report or this bill is perfect. It's not. I don't think anything is perfect. But this bill is a very strong step towards a more modern, more thoughtful statutory scheme that focuses on the most predatory behaviors and pulls out the places where folks are getting caught up in the statutes where there really isn't predatory behavior that we're concerned about. I want to thank Chair Mariani. I want to thank Representatives Mueller and O'Neill. All of you have supported this work every single step of the way. And I guess I'd like to take a moment to remember and thank Senator Ralph. He championed this work in the Senate, and we really appreciate Senator Senjum following his footsteps in the other body. You'll find organizational letters of support in your handouts. There's an anonymous letter from a survivor and a few other letters that I just saw a few minutes ago when they were posted. I can tell you that I've been in contact with many more survivors than those letters reflect. I have spent hours over the last few weeks having conversations with survivors who are interested in being a part of this, but maybe don't want to be public with their story. Many conversations with folks whose situations would have played out differently if the language around voluntary intoxication was different. If there were differences and if these recommendations were in place now, I've talked to many, many people whose stories would have looked a little bit differently. Next, you're going to hear from survivors. You're also going to hear from a number of members of the steering committee. And then it'll be your turn. Passing this bill moves us one step along this path. I think next we have Katie Kelly. And I think, I can't see if I can't, I don't, you have too many, there's too many faces. I can't tell if she's.
I'll call her forward. Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Bison.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for acknowledging the good work of Senator Ralph. And he left us some good, vital work. And, it's up to the rest of us to continue carrying that forward. So very appropriately done. Let's see if Katie is here. Katie Marie Kelly, if you're here, state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and representatives of the House Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. I'm Kathleen Kelly. I do go by Katie. I hold a Master of Fine Arts degree in musical theater. I currently live with family in District 32A, and I'm a survivor of drug-facilitated rape. My rape occurred on June 28, 2019, committed by a man I had known for 4 years and considered a friend. I completed a SANE exam and reported my rape to the Minneapolis Police Department, but the man that raped me was not charged. When I met with the prosecutor on my case to discuss why charges against my rapist were dropped, he informed me that it was a result of how the current rape laws are written. Consequently, I am just one of many victims that are turned away. In my case, there were 3 specific reasons why my case was not charged. First, date rape drugs can be eliminated from the body within a couple of hours, making it extremely difficult for blood or urine samples to accurately detect the substances, which means that the state cannot prove the use of force in non-consensual acts. Second, I was voluntarily enjoying some cocktails that evening before I lost consciousness, which meant that they could not prove that I was involuntarily intoxicated, as the current law states. Finally, because I lost consciousness, they couldn't prove I was non-communicable during the act. The rape has impacted my life in profound ways. I was diagnosed with PTSD and depression, resulting in the need for long-term mental health therapy and anti-anxiety medications. These mental health challenges have harmed my relationships with my family, which will need repairing over time. Most of all, at age 44, I don't know who I am right now. Being raped by a married man I had considered a friend has caused me to question many of my values and beliefs about men, religion, patriarchy, equity, how humans generally treat each other. I will never again be the same woman or person I was prior to this rape, and it's going to take a long time to figure out who I am now. Being raped fundamentally changes you and your perspective of the world around you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly, and please know that we greatly appreciate you being here with us today. We see you, we hear you, and we're honored that you're part of efforts here to construct better laws, stronger ways for us to prevent and to respond to the types of crimes that were perpetuated against you. Thank you for being with us here today. With that, next, I believe we have Rebecca St. George. If you can state your name for the record. I hope I have that right. If not, just state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
I believe Kayla Marie was going to go next.
Very well. Let's do that then.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, committee. Good afternoon to those other folks that are on that I've worked with over the past couple of years. My name is Keila Marie Granda. I'm the founding and executive director of Unspoken Voices, a nonprofit dedicated to violence prevention, bystander intervention, and offender rehabilitation. I received a dual bachelor's in Christian counseling and pastoral ministries. I have a master's of science in criminal justice. I hold multiple certifications and licensures in forensic psychology, crime victims' rights. I'm also a nationally certified advocate. That being said, I'm also a survivor and I am also an offender. I have worked in the fields of violence prevention my entire life, my entire adult life, and I've advocated for systems change at an intersectional level because I live on that intersection, that axis of that intersectionality. I'm a multi-ethnic, disabled, first-generation American from an extremely low SES, and I have experienced sexual exploitation and extortion. Coming into this group, I came in I've been privileged to be walking alongside Lindsay throughout this time, meeting with senators and legislators over the last 2 years, helping with this language. This is a culmination of 7 years for me, a journey of 7 years since my assault in 2013. And I first want, before I go any further, I want to say that I'm wearing a couple of hats, steering committee member, but I am, as a steering committee member, I am also bringing forward the voices of those that may have felt like their voices were not as heard, and that can be victims, offenders, that can be anyone. And in terms of justice, we need all the voices at the table. And that being said, I do believe we had a lot of consensus around this. We really did. But there are going to be a couple of things I think that Lindsay Sioka and Mike Berger might mention in terms of a couple of other language proposals that were not considered, and perhaps more on the POR group. I do have to say, though, that being said, it was my great honor to work with both the public defenders and the prosecutors on various language. And I am proud to actually support, as a steering committee member within my organization, I support the prosecutors. Well, I support the current language. As an individual who has come from a systemically sexually exploited background, things like that, it's going to sound weird, but I also believe that there are some really good merits to language that wasn't considered, and I just want that out there and to be known. But I do have to say it was an amazing experience. So that hat is off. I am done talking about the steering committee, and I want to just very quickly ask for your time and your patience. 7 years ago, I was raped by a man that was in a position of authority, position of power, a high school principal, who had previously started dating a 16-year-old student who then became his wife. This man brutally raped me over and over again. And I was at the time the Violence Prevention and Response Program Coordinator for the University of Minnesota. That shouldn't have happened to me, right? I shouldn't have let that happen, but it did. It did happen because anyone can be a victim of sexual assault. My rape kit was lost. My urine was lost. My tox results were lost. They were not able to charge. They charged on 2 first degrees and 2 third degrees under mental and physical incapacitation. However, the laws did not allow for that to occur. I have spent 7 years of my life sleepwalking through trying to make change, trying to get someone to listen, to believe the victims and the survivors out there that have not been believed. And it wasn't until serving on these groups or being part of this that I truly began to believe that change can be made. And I just want to say, just to finish it up, I want to say thank you to Senator Limmer, who really helped me in my journey at the beginning of this 2 years ago with when the creation of the working group, you know, began, but also to Representatives Moeller and O'Neill. I want to say thank you. And I want to say thank you for not only myself, but those others who have needed voices that have not been heard. And finally, I just want to say that I'm so grateful because honestly, because I lost so very, very much because of the assault. I lost my identity. I lost everything about me. I had to rethink who I was. I lived in fear for years. I didn't want to leave my home. It isn't until right now, this year, with this report, with this, what's happening, that I can say I finally got my voice back. And it's not just me, but all of the survivors that I support, all of the survivors I hopefully represent that have asked me to represent them. You are listening to our voices. You are creating systemic change. You are making it so my daughter saw the after effects of my rape, but you're making it so my daughter doesn't have to live in a world of fear and doesn't have to be afraid that what happened to her mom is going to happen to her. And I want to just say thank you, because in a world where there's so much divide, this group, Representatives Mueller and O'Neill, you brought this together. And it's nothing short of a miracle to me. And I just want to say thank you for letting me be part of this journey. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grandall. Please know we hear your voice, and we are good with hearing your voice, and we're good that you're good with having your voice be heard. Continued love and well wishes on your journey toward healing. Thank you for your courage to be here with us today. I believe perhaps next is Rebecca St. George. I hope I have that right. If so, please come forward. Give us your name and your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. Buju, Wawate Kwe Indigenakas, Nagaji Wanung and Dojaba, Minama Namein Dem, Dodem. Pardon me. In English, my name is Rebecca St. George. When I started this committee, I was working for the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Since then, I have moved on to, I'm now the city attorney for Duluth. Today, I am not representing the city of Duluth, though I'm here as a committee member. And it has been a huge honor to me to be a part of this committee and to be able to work alongside of these amazing women you're hearing from today. They are so smart and so strong. My history of working with sexual violence has been primarily in Indian country. As a Native woman, we are more likely than others by like 3 times to be raped. We're more likely to have more violence used against us and to end up with more injuries. This is generally true for women of color, which is not to say that rape doesn't happen to anyone anytime. It does. And it's awful. I heard one of the representatives, I didn't catch who it was before we started, saying that her daughter had mentioned to her that most of her friends have been sexually assaulted. That is a tragedy. I can tell you that I don't know Native women who have not been sexually assaulted. It's that common, and it's that awful. And most of us never go to the police. Most of us never report it, partly because of stories like Kila Marie's, because of stories like Katie's. We know we're going to be re-victimized. We know the law is not set up to help us. It's not set up to make things better for us. And I won't take a lot of time with this, but I just want you to know that making these changes isn't going to fix that. But it will go far in at least defining some of the things. One of the things that happens with sexual assault is you end up feeling so alone and so isolated and so often like it's your fault and like it doesn't matter. And to have our representatives stand up and say, not only does it matter, but it's a crime, and we are willing to define these things that happen to that right now under Minnesota state law are not crimes. They're still horrible and they still can rip your life apart, but technically they're not a crime. And for you all to stand up and say, you know what? they are and we care enough to do something about it, it makes a difference. And even if people don't always use it, they see that and they feel that, and we know, we pay attention. So thank you for your time with this. Thank you for the work you're doing on this. Thank you for mandating the committee so that we can do it. And I will pass it along to Karen Long now, Miigwech.
Thank you, Ms. St. George, and it does matter. And you know, we have Democrats, Republicans on this committee. There are a lot of things we don't agree on. I am certain that we all agree on your advice that this does matter. We will be working with you and others to enshrine that in our laws. All right, very well. Corinne Long, please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Karen Long, and I am a staff attorney at the Advocates for Human Rights in Minneapolis. We have a women's rights program that advocates for women's rights issues both in Minnesota and with our international partners. Prior to that, though, for almost 20 years, I've been a prosecutor in Minnesota, working on violence against women as my main passion. And sexual violence in particular has been my area of focus. I'm also previously a staff attorney at Lindsay's organization at MnCASA. Most recently, before taking this position just over a year ago, I worked at the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. And I want to just say hi to Dave Pinto, who's on this committee. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing this bill. There's nothing I can say to follow the testimony that you just heard that can give it any more emphasis as to how important all these measures are. I do want to talk in particular a little bit about the conversations that we had or the decisions that we reached about the voluntary intoxication measure. As you heard from our testifiers, this is an ongoing and highly problematic gap in Minnesota law. So having been both an advocate at MnCASA and having been a prosecutor for almost 20 years, I would say that when it comes to sexual assault prosecution in Minnesota, the number one ongoing concern of advocates and criminal legal professionals is the gap that we have in addressing the sexual violence and sexual exploitation of individuals who have become intoxicated voluntarily. So the common interpretation of our current mentally incapacitated language is that the victim must be administered the intoxicant without their agreement. So it has commonly been interpreted that it cannot apply if the victim drank or used other substances voluntarily. And I don't feel like I can explain it any better than those who have already spoken this morning or this afternoon, but it is a very difficult position to be in as a prosecutor who does this work because we want to address sexual violence and to have to tell someone that although you were highly intoxicated, you were not unconscious, and therefore the law does not prohibit the sexual violence that happened to you. I think there is widespread agreement, and certainly I was on the steering committee for this working group, and certainly among the members of that steering committee and the subcommittee, there was an agreement that we needed to address this particular issue. And as has been pointed out, there were two different options that came out of those conversations. But there was an agreement at a minimum that the problem was a gap that needed to be addressed. Obviously, not addressing the sexual harm of highly intoxicated people sends a dangerous and ambiguous message about what behavior actually crosses the line and causes real harm. So this working group Representative Moeller has put forward option one from the group, which uses, and I just want to talk a little bit about what it does. It uses existing language as to the perpetrator's level of knowledge. So existing and current statute, if the perpetrator knows or has reason to know of intoxication, that he can be held accountable. What this does is it defines the level of intoxication that the state has to prove in order to hold somebody accountable criminally. And we all know that criminal statutes, in fairness and under our Constitution, must be very clearly drafted and there must be a clear line. And so that was the conversation that our working group had, our subcommittee. And we looked at statutes from many states, and we had some very serious conversations about how to define when a person crosses the line into criminal behavior. And that's where we came up with the definition that when the complainant is under the influence of an intoxicating substance to the point that they are incapable of consenting or incapable of appreciating, understanding, or controlling their conduct. And the perpetrator, again, knows or has reason to know of that, that ought to be criminalized and not have to fall back on either being essentially unconscious so that they actually fit into a physical helpless definition. And I think Katie explained why that's insufficient. Or, again, having to prove that the intoxicant was administered without their agreement. And so, as I said, we compared many statutes around the country. We had many good conversations, and this is the recommendation that we have. And I'll just wrap it up by thanking Representatives Moeller and O'Neill for their long-time commitment to these issues and for all the work that they're doing to bring these forward. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Long, and thank you for your work. With the Advocates for Human Rights and also your prior work with my county's county attorney. Ms. Christina Warren from Hennepin County, if you can come forward and state your name for the record and give us your testimony, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having both myself as well as the other members of our steering committee testify before you this afternoon. I don't have a lot to add that Representative Moeller and Representative O'Neill shared with respect to some of the changes we made on age-based language. But I did want to just point out that, as Representative O'Neill indicated, in order to achieve our greater goal of making sure that these statutes not only best allow us to get justice for our victim survivors in as many situations as we possibly can, but we also want to make sure that these statutes are user-friendly and are used in a way or are drafted in a way that allows our law enforcement partners to easily access the language, apply the language, because as everyone knows, that's oftentimes where these cases start. Many cases don't hit our desks as prosecutors. If the responding officers and investigators don't know the language of the statutes and how to apply facts that come before them from our victims in order to know what to do with them. And I just say that mainly because our work, I think that we've been able to do in the last 18 months does a lot to better position ourselves to give justice to victims. Especially thank you, Ms. Kelly, for speaking. One of our greater goals in starting this working group and participating from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Oh, I neglected to tell you who I am. I assume that you all know, like I'm Cher. I'm not. I am Christina Warren. I'm a senior attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. And I have had the great fortune of, for the last 2 years, working on a new initiative that Mike Freeman started in my office. It's the Sexual Assault Initiative. And along with James Hanneman, we have been working on improving how we as an office and how we can better help support our law, our partners in law enforcement in addressing CSC cases. So that's what that's my background, and that's what I've been focused on. And as
can you
a,
get those as you grow other flowers?
Nope. Sorry, I thought there was a question. And then I'm soon going to be the site coordinator for our new SACI project with Minneapolis Police Department, thanks to a federal grant we received. So all of that said, we do have more work to do, and I'm hopeful that we will have the opportunity to continue to work closely with these incredible representatives who are doing more for the criminal justice system and more for the people in Minnesota than I think they could maybe ever fully appreciate, and thank you for them. Just quickly, when you're looking at the age-related changes, as Representative O'Neill indicated, we are going to make a couple of tweaks and a couple of added changes, but rather than do a full and complete overhaul of the statute, given the time and resources that we had, what we wanted to do is address some of the main problems with our kid cases. And that is first to broaden or sort of widen the net of protection over certain children. Right now, as you know, there's this, before this language in this bill, it was 12 and under. Well, why? Why not 13? If you look at it from sort of a practical standpoint, what we're talking about when we're raising the age to 13 is really protecting middle schoolers from high schoolers coming to middle school and have sex with them. Oftentimes these cases are maybe not recognized or swept under a rug of perceived peer-on-peer consensual conduct. And that's why this age differential really matters. What we're talking about is protecting the eighth grader from the junior or senior in high school from driving over and picking up, you know, a sex partner from the middle school parking lot. That's offensive and wrong in every way. And we had great support for that. And that is maybe the best way of describing how and why we came up with that age change. And the other changes, I think, Representatives O'Neill and Moeller spoke to, as well as Suzanne Elwell. And so with that, I'll stay on for any questions, but thank you all very, very much. And thank you to Suzanne Elwell for leading this sometimes argumentative and challenging group.
Thank you, Ms. Warren. Representative Moeller, we've got 15 minutes left. I do want to move your bill because it's going to need to make that stop in judiciary. It's also going to have to come back here. And so I'm just sort of tipping, you know, to our members that we're going to see this bill again, unless judiciary just stops it, but I don't think that's going to happen. Either way, we'll pull it up. And so we do have, we have five testifiers. I do want to hear your voices. Please come forward. I'll call you out. Please be as super concise as possible. Please know that we will be back with this bill again. It's important that we keep moving so that the bill just doesn't, you know, stop. I will call us at in about 15 minutes for a vote. And if there's still time left, we're able to, I'll continue to take testimony. I know I have several members that want to ask some questions as well. So first up, we have Luis Rangel Morales with Neighbor Justice Center, followed by Stacy Bettison and Patty Wetterling. Luis Rangel Morales, please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Chair, would I be able to allow Ms. Wetterling and other people to speak before me? And then if I still have time, I can make the comments. I think I'd like to hear what they have to say.
Yes,
and I think in the agenda, they were first. Too, so.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rahim Morales. I have a different order here, but I'm certainly fine with that. We do have Ms. Wetterling.
Stacy may have something to add to it. I want to keep my comments incredibly short, but I thank you all. This is really an important piece of legislation, and these changes need to happen, and I'm fully in support of them, and I really want to thank Katie, Kilo Marie, and Rebecca for sharing their stories and getting their voices out there. My my work has been always trying to protect children, and the law we passed for sex offender registration was passed 30 years ago. And what has happened over the years is it keeps getting strengthening because people are angry about sexual violence, and as I am as well. But it's time to look at what part is working and what part is not. And some of the language that is used to address sexual violence for adults, really when applied to youth, teenagers and our children, it's not appropriate. It doesn't work, and it causes more harm than good. There's research to show the kids on a registry are more likely to become victims of sexual assault. They're more likely to commit suicide. A lot of harm can happen to these kids, and they're children. They made a mistake. There's some surveys that show that of the adults that are interviewed, by the time that they are 18, you know, in their youth, 70% to 70% of them were victimized by another child. And what happens, that's not what the police reports say. Their reports are only about 35%. So what happens is people don't want to report if it's their neighbor or their brother or, you know, a babysitter that's so known to the family. So the victim doesn't get support, and the child with problematic sexual behavior doesn't get any help. What we want to do is prevent sexual violence, get that kid some help. There's high rate of success for kids who get help, especially at earlier ages. So I'm thrilled that you're going to have a committee and you will have the time. So it's a complex problem, but I spent a year on this problem with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. There's a lot of research and a lot of really gifted solutions on how to make it better. So thank you for the work that you do every day.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wendling. It's a privilege and an honor to have you in our committee. I do need to technically have you state your name on the record.
I am Patricia Wetterling. I'm a child advocate. That's about it. Jacob's well. Mom, thank you.
Thank you so much. Stacy Bettison?
Hi, thank you. My name is Stacy Bettison. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I do contract work as a public defender in Ramsey County. I will also keep my comments brief. I had wanted to say more, but I will echo Patty Wetterling has said. As I was a member of the working group, and I appreciated what everyone brought. What became clear to us is, as we were talking about modifying the criminal sexual conduct laws, we also needed to be talking about the predatory offender registry. We can't have a conversation about one without considering the impact to the other. And with the changes here, we will see an increase in the registry. The registry, as Ms. Wetterling noted, was passed 30 years ago. It hasn't been looked at in an analytical sense since its passage. It's just been added on to. And now is the time to consider what is working and what is not. In our working group, I will say that we talked we talked about getting juveniles off the registry as a priority and requiring registration only for convictions. So getting rid of the probable cause or similar set of circumstances that also can make a person required to register. We achieved consensus on those two items, and so my request today is I support the Predatory Offender Working Group. That is a wonderful thing, and thank you for adding that in. My request would be, we had consensus on the juveniles and the probable cause, same and similar set. I would request that be added into this bill. Those are things that we feel confident about getting the kids off, and the probable cause language is in that supplement too for consideration. I will stop there because we also have Professor Janice and two other attorneys.
Thank you, Ms. Bettison. Next we have Eric Janice, Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Eric Janice. I'm a law professor at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, although, of course, speaking only for myself today. And I'll be very brief. First of all, I want to acknowledge and recognize and thank the survivors, the victims who've so courageously come and spoken today. I want to emphasize that my perspective is a focus on prevention, and so and a focus on the registry and what I have come to view as a unintended consequence of the registry. It's strayed very far from its original intentions. And so I applaud the recommendation of the working group and the provision in this piece of legislation that would create a working group to study the registry. I think we've learned a huge amount about sexual violence prevention during the 30 years since the original registry was established. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the registry has minimal benefit in terms of prevention and may have some perverse and unintended consequences that actually makes our society less safe and are antithetical to the prevention, a comprehensive prevention effort. So I understand that the bill is written right now, calls for a working group, and I applaud that and stand ready to help in any way that I can. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very, very well. Thank you, sir. Not at all unusual, but unfortunately, we don't always do it in the legislature to stop and pause and assess good works and efforts that we've attempted before. Finally, we have Lindsay Sioka, a supervising attorney with the Person Felony Unit. You'll have to describe that. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Sioka. I am a supervising attorney in the 4th Judicial District Public Defender's Office. Specifically, the Person Felony team that I supervise handles criminal sexual conduct cases. So we represent people accused of criminal sexual assault. And we also try a great deal of those cases. And I would just note before my comments that many of our clients who are charged with criminal sexual conduct cases are our clients and defendants one day, and on the next day can also be a victim. So I would just note that I take that into consideration. I was a member of the criminal sexual conduct working group in my capacity as a managing attorney or supervising attorney in the public defender's office. And have worked alongside the prosecutors in the working group and also with the victim advocates and survivors as well. I also just want to acknowledge the work with those individuals and their understanding that much of the work we do at the public defender's office is to make sure the process is fair as possible. People get zealous representation and we understand their story and their background and that the process is fair. And we're recognizing individuals who are charged with crimes and their stories and not just the crime itself. So also, I would just echo the comments very briefly and first that the Predatory Offender Working Group, I support that. That was a big discussion in many of the committees that I served on the Criminal Sexual Conduct Working Group. And almost every committee recognized and understood that the Predatory Offender Registration needs essentially an overhaul and significant revision and needs analysis. Second, I've listened to everyone and I just want to thank everyone for their participation and the lively discussions in the working group. And I understand the need for addressing a gap in the criminal sexual conduct statutes that calls for a provision that prevents those who are too intoxicated to consent to sexual activity. And that we need to make sure that we're preventing predatory behavior that would impact those who are too intoxicated to consent. However, I was a big proponent of the alternative proposal that's in the report that came out of the working group that Ms. Elwell talked about in her portion of her testimony. One of the main reasons that I am not supporting the voluntary intoxication statute as it's currently being proposed in the bill is that it essentially creates a double standard in the law for the way we're evaluating intoxication as it comes to complainants and defendants in a criminal trial and in criminal cases. What the law does as it's currently proposed is does acknowledge that someone can be too intoxicated to consent to sexual activity, but it does not allow for a defendant to then also raise the issue of intoxication as a defense. Ms. Long kind of acknowledged this in some of her testimony that we kind of looked at how this would actually play out in a criminal trial. but if one can be too intoxicated by their words or actions to consent to sexual activity, that another person could be too intoxicated to perceive that individual's inability to consent as well. To highlight this, I want to quickly just bring up the concept of alcoholic blackouts. We had experts talk to our working group about this concept, about how at some point when someone consumes large amounts of alcohol, their brain will essentially stop recording, or their memory will stop recording far before their motor skills stop, meaning that someone who consumes large amounts of alcohol can walk, talk, text, and drive long and have no memory of that behavior the next day. So if two people are together consuming alcohol, engage in some kind of sexual activity, both wake up and don't remember what happened, one can think they were sexually assaulted and result in criminal charges against the other, but that other individual could not bring up intoxication as a defense that they also didn't know what happened and didn't know at which point both neither could potentially have been able to consent. So I bring that up as creating a double standard in the law with the statute, and as it's currently written, would not allow for intoxication as a defense, which I think brings up a significant issue. I would also note that throughout the working group discussions, when we talked about this issue, that it was recognized that intoxication should be a defense to this if both parties have consumed alcohol. I also note from my team's experience in trying these cases fairly regularly that we get questions from juries about, is intoxication a defense? And if we're about to make intoxication or taking advantage of people while they're too intoxicated to consent to crime, it should also be a defense if you're too intoxicated to perceive another individual's words or actions. The aim of this, and I understand that we want to be able to prevent predatory behavior by taking advantage of those who are too intoxicated to consent to sexual activity, but we don't want to cast the net too wide and over-criminalize otherwise legal behavior. We want to make sure that the process is a fair one to both sides, to make sure that this is a valid law and it gets played out in criminal courts the way it should be, with both sides getting a fair trial and this process being a fair one. So I would encourage this committee to take a look at the alternative proposal in the working report. I do think that a specific intent provision or an intoxication defense would help make this a more balanced provision in the statutes. I would note that Wisconsin has a very similar provision that calls for a specific intent and purpose driven statute. It is used, that burden is not too high, and they regularly use it to charge out the crimes that this committee and this working group is seeking to include in the criminal statutes. So I thank you all for your time and for your work. I thank everyone in the working group for the very lively discussion, kind of open concept to help making sure we did a good job. And thank you again.
Thank you, Ms. Sayoka. Representative Mueller, I suspect that assuming the bill goes forward, that in judiciary, this will most likely be a central conversation. Probably be one if the bill, as the bill comes back our way as well. We do have Mr. Ranje Morales.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair and committee members, and thank you for your time today. My name is Luis Rangel, and I'm an attorney for the Neighborhood Justice Center. I also participated in the working group that served as the basis for the bill currently proposed. And I just want to say two things. I have prepared remarks, Chair, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. I'd just like to thank Susan for her guidance and mediation throughout this entire process. She has gone out of her way to speak with me and I assume everybody else who served on the working group. And second, I also understand the need to want to protect certain populations and the need to penalize certain behavior. That's not lost on me, and I'm sure not on any of the other defense attorneys who are providing testimony today. It's understandable and necessary that we do correct some of these behaviors. I don't want to sound dismissive of the testimony that has been heard today by individuals that I've had conversations with and gotten to know a little better while working in this working group. To build off what Ms. Sayoka was commenting on, we have a lot of work to do in our criminal justice system. And it's no secret that people of color are disproportionately entangled in this punitive process. So let's not forget that when Ms. Sayoka is talking about individuals that she represents, that I represent, we're talking about a disproportionate population. We're talking about individuals from a social economic status that tends to be poor, and we're talking about individuals that tend to be people of color. So with that said, this proposal, as it's being written, only makes the situation worse. I think we can all agree that too many people of color in the state of Minnesota are incarcerated, and that needs to be fixed. So when actual change to help remedy this was proposed, which was the predatory offender registration, in which all the participants that were present shared a common concern about its broadness, about its punitive effect, in which we actually agreed to on certain proposals, while acknowledged by the authors of the bill, in my opinion, they appear to be disregarded because it's not included in the bill. Second, there's latent effects of trying to protect one group that has not, in the attempt of trying to protect one group, we may and are contributing to impacting other individuals. And I mean people of color. And we need to draft laws that we know will work, not that we hope will work. A good example of this is the current predatory offender registration system that was drafted with good intentions and with the hope of helping individuals like Ms. Wetterling. Certainly that has had latent and unintended consequences that we are talking about today. The language proposed would serve to address the concerns present today, certainly, but the language goes way beyond that. Some of the proposed changes have drastic punitive changes, which were only lightly addressed in the working group. Ultimately, these changes will have life-altering repercussions for behavior and scenarios that are not discussed today, not discussed or thought of today, which may not warrant these type of consequences. Ms. Warren, when she provided her testimony, she highlighted a situation of the 13-year-old and now making that 14 years old. The difference between that as a punitive consequence, I thought was more severe than what it was alluded to. An 18-year-old today who has consensual sex with someone who's 13 faces roughly a state sentence of 36 months, I believe, something along those lines. So they're not looking at going to prison. The proposed change would make that same 18-year-old be looking at 144 months in prison. That is an enormous, drastic consequence. I only highlight that because it was something that Ms. Warren alluded to. And I think it's something that the individuals voting today need to understand just how drastic the changes are. When provided with an option, the bill adopted the broadest language from a set of proposals. If our current statistics are any indication of who will be prosecuted for this, we know that they will be disproportionately poor and people of color. I wholeheartedly agree that we need to improve the criminal justice response to sexual assault. We can protect individuals such as those referenced by Representative O'Neill and the people who testified today. And we can do that without compounding the problem that we already face and that we are dealing with the reckoning of in this past year in the criminal justice system. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Jorge Morales. Representative Mueller, we've got a couple of minutes left only. It truly is the chair's desire to have judiciary dig into this bill, including some of the issues that were raised here toward the end. This bill will come back here. It has to for fiscal reasons, plus the chair is going to bring it back regardless. And I think it'll be good for us to be able to spend time between them, working on some of these issues. And I would fully expect, a debate here in committee at that time. I will call on Representative Johnson very quickly. And then I do want us to move to a vote. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Mueller, and to the entire committee that worked on this, I want to thank you. It was a lot of great work. I'm disappointed in some of the testimony I heard. There is still some concerns on things, but I know as an investigator doing investigations of these as a law enforcement officer, I had quite a few where alcohol consumption was an issue, not only by the perpetrator, but also by the victim. And I was able to get convictions in that with most of them being plea bargains. So I'm disappointed that the attorneys are saying they can't charge in those things because law enforcement can only bring forward the case where it's the attorneys have to charge, and it's more work, but it can be done. If this makes it easier, it's better for the victims. My goal as an investigating these was putting a case together that the victim never had to go on the stand and relive that horrible experience again. I'm also disappointed in the amount of time that is taken for us. We have I'm sure there's a number of questions and a couple of issues that need to be taken. And I would request that the chair have the author on the floor request it be moved to the other committee instead of voted on here, then bring it back so we have a good long time to actually discuss some of the issues that need to be done as we're out of time. I know before there was a lot more people had their hands up for questions, and we are out of time. So instead of voting on it, I'm going to ask if the chair would recommend on the floor today the author have it just moved without a vote at this time.
Fair enough, Representative Johnson. However, I do want us just to handle it here. You've heard my intent on the record. This bill will be back, and we will spend time more than just moving it in terms of an omnibus bill. I'm convinced by the testimony of the need to do that. So if you're willing to trust the chair's commitment to that, I just assume move straight forward and then we'll be having it come back.
I understand the chair's desire to do that, but like I say, there was six people up with questions. We've not even had an opportunity to ask one question to an entire witness on this or at the testifiers, let alone discuss the bill with the author. We've just had an explanation. I have a hard time voting for something when we don't have answers to questions. We don't have opportunity to other people to ask questions or even to question the testifiers on this issue. Who's to say when we finally bring this up that these testifiers will be here to answer the questions for some of the testimony they gave?
Fair enough, Representative Johnson. And members, it's always possible for you to pass at a vote as well. You have my statement on the record in terms of my intent. Representative Mulder, 5-10 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the testifiers. I always remain open to discussions about the bill. Haven't heard from a lot of the folks with concerns, so you know how to reach me, and I would ask for the members' support and continue to work on this bill. Thank you.
Very well. With that, the chair moves that House File 707 as amended be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Pass.
Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Pass.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Novotny? Representative Novotny? Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill votes aye.
Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Poston?
Pass.
Representative Rowley?
Raleigh, pass.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Navani was a yes. I just couldn't get the screen to go.
Thank you. That's noted. That is 14 ayes and 3 abstains and 2 excused.
Very well. Out of all the 14 ayes, 3 abstains and 2 excused, House File 707 as amended is referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Members, again, we will be hearing this bill again, and I look forward to a good, strong debate at that time. With that, members, thank you, Representative Mueller, and thank you to all the testifiers for your powerful witness here today. Members, with that, we're gonna convene again tomorrow at our regular time. And so until then, this committee stands adjourned.